30th, 2006. Please note that Senator Schrader and Representative Scott are excused at this point.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. You had asked me to give a brief overview of item 14 and what it is that this item is. This, the Departments of Higher Education and Community Colleges and Workforce Development are jointly reporting to you as mandated by Senate Bill 342, which was passed last session. Senate Bill 342 was a bill that you passed requiring the operation of a statewide articulation and transfer system to promote the transfer of credits for students who transfer between community colleges and higher education institutions, and among those institutions as well. That bill required a progress report to the emergency board, which the two departments are fulfilling that mandate here. The bill also requires a number of specific actions, which this report is providing feedback to you on progress on those actions that are mandated under Senate Bill 342.
The agency and DAS, please come forward. The agency, please start at your own leisure.
Good morning, Chairman Devlin and members of the committee. For the record, Cam Pryce-Brawley, Commissioner of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. With me today is the Chair of the State Board of Education, Dr. Jerry Berger, and Chancellor Bernsteiner, and we're going to ask Dr. Berger, to provide the overview of Senate Bill 342 as the work of that bill was to be, if you will, marshaled through the joint boards of education.
Before you start, Doctor, I think I might note for the record that I believe the two chief co-sponsors of that were Representative Wayne Scott and Senator Schrader. So please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Berger. I happen to be a member of the State Board of Education. This year, I happen to be chair of the State Board of Education. But for the past 2 years, I was chair of the group formed by the Oregon Higher Ed Board and the Board of Education, a joint committee, to address the issues that were outlined in Senate Bill 342. We also addressed the issues in Senate Bill 300, which is also in the report. But I know this is for Senate Bill 342. First of all, I want to thank Commissioner Pryce-Brawley, Chancellor Bernsteiner, for giving us the assistance and giving the group the power that this was very, very important work. When you take 7 universities, 17 community colleges, which are all independent institutions, and trying to get them to work together, we needed some assistance. But we did get wonderful assistance from those 23, 24 institutions on working on these issues. You have a report which has an executive summary, and it's outlined in what we accomplished. It's outlined on what we are working on presently, and in some cases, what some long-term plans are. So this is a progress report. It isn't done. Everything is not done. What I'd like to do is very briefly go through the major areas and tell you where we are, and then I would give my two colleagues the opportunity to add to what I didn't cover, and then open it up for questions. One of the issues is the AAOT, which is the transfer program that basically was developed 15 years ago, and in education that means a lot of changes, and we attempted to look at, and we are looking at, how does the AAOT fit, what are all the AAOT in different institutions, and every institution has a different AAOT requirements for their institutions. At one time, I was president of Schenectady Community College, and even today, they're in their AAOT, they have physical education required. State system higher education, I think in most of the institutions, don't require physical education for any majors. Therefore, even there, you have differences. So students have to struggle. Do they want to get an AAOT? How much of that really does transfer? How much is electives? And we're working on that. That's a major thing to take a look at the AAOT. Do we need to update them? Do institutions need to update them around the state? What would be covered, et cetera? But it has been it's been working, except what it happens is the major problem which is identified when students change majors, it has huge impact on them when they go to institutions. If you were an automotive mechanic major, then you decided to become an architect, there's impact on the student because everything will transfer, but it might count as elective, but you still have a lot of major requirements to do. Another thing we worked on was the degree pathways, and we focused on four areas: engineering, teacher preparation, nursing, allied health professions. We've made a huge strides in the pathways where we now have working agreements among community colleges and four-year schools on teacher preparation. We are looking at engineering, and we have agreements on what's required. So if a student knows they're going into teacher preparation, there's a plan of what they need to take, what they need to score, where they can transfer. It's really good work. So students in those four areas, we've really clarified how they go and how they transfer. The other thing we're working at is each school has general education requirements. We have a group working which are outlining what the general ed requirements are, and I think in the next 2 years we'll have agreement what we're trying to get at in general education, so when a student transfers, they will be finished with, if they finish that core, they will be finished with the general ed requirements when they do transfer. We also, along this, and a lot of these dovetail together on transfer, when you talk about AOT, you talk about general ed outcomes, they all run together. So, but we're also looking at all the 102-level classes. We have committees looking at how they fit together, how they, a community college class at 100 level will go into a 200 level, will go into a 300 level in the higher education system, and we have people working on that. Major work has been done on what's called the Atlas system, which is really a system that a student can go online, take a look at what is required for a major, take a look at his or her schedule of classes they're taking wherever in the system. This is at Chemeketa to OSU, Eastern Oregon to University of Oregon, and they can, by going to their own computer or wherever they're on the computer, can look and see if they're taking the courses and what courses are needed, how they transfer those courses. This is probably one of the key things, and I think we've asked for funding, more funding on that, or continued funding to get this done, so students can self-advise themselves regarding what's needed, what isn't needed. It's a powerful tool. We're on progress, and we're making, I think we, all the university systems, I think, are connected. We're now getting community college connected, and by hopefully in 2 years that will be, it's never completed because there's changes, you have to update it, et cetera, but the technology will be there. And you won't need to go to somebody and say, what do I need? You can go to your computer and you can find out what you need. A great use of technology and actually a huge staff saving because you can put responsible people can go to that, look at it, figure it out, and make choices. One of the huge, and this is done now, is, as you know, and I'm sure you've heard about advanced placement scores, which is a national testing survey. Take them in high schools. And we reached agreement on over 33 advanced placement tests that if you score at a certain level, you will get a certain number of credits at all of these institutions. Prior to this work, every institution on their own set the scores. A four gave you 3 credits at University of Oregon, and a 4 might have given you 7 credits at Oregon State University. So high school students were looking at all these changing things. We've reached agreement on advanced placement scores are uniform throughout the state. So if you get a certain score, you are guaranteed this number of credits in that area at all of these institutions. That was a tremendous amount of work by both staffs of working that out, because you had to go through faculty senates, you had to go through curriculum committees, and and everybody eventually got into the it's incredible advancement for, and it's really a boon for Oregonians and students. The Senate Bill 300 I might hit briefly, and that was expanding options for students in the K-12 system. We have adopted rules on that. We are looking at that. We have ways of helping the student in high school. For example, if you're at South Salem High School and your really goal is might be automotive mechanics, there's systems where you can go and perhaps go to Chemeketa Community College while you're a junior or a senior and get credits, and there's a variety of efforts going on in that. In short, I think that kind of summarizes an overview of the report. We have more people talking with each other regarding the transitions among institutions, and actually this is focusing on higher education, but there's a tremendous amount of work of the K-12 system in transitions to either the world of work or to higher education. So there's a lot of good work going on. On the second page of the report, I would like to point out that Jerry Blackney from the State Board of Higher Ed, Bridget Burns, State Board of Higher Ed, James Sager, Governor's Office, Gretchen Schutte, State Board of Higher Education, Nikki Squire, State Board of Education, Tony Van Fleet were very, very important colleagues working on this these efforts. With that, I'd turn it over to either one of the
Thank you very much, Doctor. Mr. Chancellor, Madam Commissioner, if you have anything to add, please add it.
Mr. Chair, thanks very much. George Pernsteiner, Chancellor of the University System. I think Dr. Berger has mentioned many of the details. Let me add 2 things, if I might. In addition to my thanks to the leadership that you all showed during the last session in enacting this legislation. First thing is that the purpose of the legislation was to facilitate student success and student progress, regardless of where in the state the student might be attending school, to try to find ways to remove barriers, to clarify pathways, to find ways to provide students with opportunities that would allow them to receive appropriate college credit for the work that they were doing, whether they're doing it in the high school, in the community college, or at the university. That's important because it is a system-wide look at education in this state. And in order to do that, the second thing had to occur, which is that not just the State Board of Education and the Board of Higher Education, not just the staffs of the organizations, but the faculty of the community colleges, the faculty of some of the high schools, the faculty of the universities, and even in certain cases with regard to general education outcomes, the faculty at the independent colleges in the state have worked together and are continuing to work together in order to ensure student success. I think it's very important, and this legislation provided the framework in which we could engage in those conversations. Yes, we have a long way to go. We know that. We also know, though, that many, many students are already taking advantage of this. Many, many students already attend community colleges and transfer to the universities. Many students already are taking AP exams. This will facilitate success for them going forward. Last fall, before this really became effective, we approved 630,000 transfer credits from various institutions coming into the 7 universities. This is a big part of education in this state, and we're trying to make this then function a lot more successfully for students, and I thank you for your leadership in helping us to make that happen.
Madam Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. I could only echo Chancellor Bernsteiner's comments about the faculty have really done the heavy lifting, and it did take leadership on your behalf of putting a challenge in front of us of the Joint Boards of Education to say we shall be responsive to this, but it really was the faculty at the 24 institutions and pardon me, and also public and private institutions to bring this to fruition. You've been given an astounding number of 600,000 credits. I was checking on earlier today the number of students from high school that transferred to community colleges and the number of credits. And I thought it was of note that we currently have over 1,700 students that are enrolled in the Expanded Options Program as of this fall. It's the kickoff. 1,700 is a considerably larger number than we had expected. And that's in addition to 81,000 credits that were earned last year in dual enrollment and tech prep courses. So what you can see is that the trend line is up. It's what you expect, and it's what we intend to deliver. So thank you for your time.
Any questions for you?
Department of Administrative Services. Morning, Mr. Chair. Bill McGee from Department of Administrative Services. We recommend you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Mr. Chair, Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends that you acknowledge receipt of the report. We also note that at the Fiscal Office, we tend to be very interested in the fiscal implications of what's going on in the report. We do want to note that the report really does not address that. It does indicate that some additional funding would be necessary to continue the efforts that were discussed this morning, and that next session the legislature will need to evaluate any fiscal requests that come before it relating to continuing or expanding these efforts.
Davis, questions? Do we have a motion? It's been moved that we accept the report. Are there any objections? Hearing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chancellor, are you going to stay for the next three items?
Mr. Chair, we are going to another committee to vote for the report. But Dr. Kenton is here.
Okay. Thank you. We will go on to items 10, 11, and 12. I'll carry the first one, unless Representative Scott is someone's way to want to. We'll go on to 10, 11, and 12. And, Mr. Bender, those are all the capital improvements.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So please proceed.
Mr. Chair, the next three items that are coming forward are three capital construction requests from the Department of Higher Education. All of them are coming before you as to the emergency board as opposed to waiting until the next session because there are issues related to their timing that would make a delay of approval until the next session would impose additional costs on the projects. The first of these before you is a project to redevelop the block of land on the Portland State campus that currently houses the Portland Center for Advanced Technology. And that will be presented to you first.
Please proceed.
Chairman Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor of Finance, the Oregon University System. With me today is President Dan Bernstein, PSU President, and his Vice President, Dr. Lindsay DeRochet. And we are here to request that you establish a $51 million project limitation for the PCAT redevelopment project. That's a project that would be funded with $42 million in Article 11 F1 bonds and $9 million in other funds, and authorize the university to construct a new mixed-use facility at Portland State. I will let President Bernstein introduce this item, and then we'll briefly summarize and answer questions.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Dan Bernstein. I'm president of Portland State University. This project, which is to develop what we call the PCAT block, is really a culmination of over 10 years of work with the city, Metro TriMet to bring light rail to our campus, along with the development of the transit mall. Because the Green Line now is has been assured, it's important for us to coordinate development of this block to minimize the disruption as light rail and the development of the PCAT block go hand in hand. So this development project is very important to the overall campus plan and helps to complete the front door to our campus, along with the current urban center, streetcar, and the upcoming light rail.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay DeRoche, Vice President at Portland State, for the record. As the President said, we've been working with TriMet, the city, and all parties in the city for some time to coordinate activities in relation to the light rail. And the map that you have before you shows, actually it's called the Green Line, but we put it in red. So you see with that red line what the shape of the light rail is. And the letter A indicates where the PCAT building is located, which is just south of the urban plaza. Between 5th and 6th Southwest, 5th and 6th Avenues. This project is a project that will be about 200,000 square feet. It's a long-awaited recreation center for students. It will involve some additional retail services on the first floor, which will pay for themselves. It will also involve classroom space and some office space in coordination with the Chancellor's office. Ultimately, the project will be 6 to 7 floors and will provide a home for the Graduate School of Social Work or a School of Business, and we're still deliberating on that. In Phase 1, which is before you today, it's approximately 140,000 square feet, and it will be built for all these purposes. And the project does have broad support from the community because it meets the serious need for some more classrooms and additional space for recreation. Students on our campus frequently do not recreate on campus. They simply don't have the space in the old Stott Center. The building will complete the urban plaza and the transit stops for the TriMet project, and we are working in tandem with TriMet to get this project done on the same timeline, and hence the reason to bring it forward to you. If the project is delayed, there could be significantly more increased cost in relation to the construction because of the tracks that would be laid on 5th and 6th Avenues. So that's a very brief summary. Be very happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Did you have anything to add?
Just add, Chairman Devlin, thank you, that this project was reviewed and approved by the board at their November 3rd meeting, and the board leadership felt it was very important to the city of Portland and, you know, to facilitate this project. You'll note that the Chancellor's office is going to make an investment in this building of $6 million, three of which would be to obtain space in the facility. We're going to fund that with the proceeds from the pending sale of the Capitol Center, which is a facility that we own that is sold, has been sold, is under contract to be sold on 185th and Walker in Beaverton. And the other financing is just a bridge loan to help the university expedite the project at this time.
Mr. Bender, can you clarify on this, the issue I brought forward to you?
Yes. Mr. Chair, you had asked me about the Article 11 F1 bonds that would be approved for this project. This would include $42 million of Article 11 F1 bonds. The bonds would be repaid from a combination of student recreation and building fees, and also from rents on retail space that would be part of the new facility. These would not actually be an addition to the amount of Article 11 F1 bonds that were approved during the session, because at least under the LFO recommendation, you would be transferring $42 million in Article 11 F1 bond proceeds for a project that PSU is not planning to move forward on to this project. You had approved $42 million in F bonds for a combined fitness, recreation center, and housing project that had been anticipated to be constructed at another location. Because the university now wishes to put the recreation and fitness center at the site of the old PCAT facility, they will not need the $42 million in bonds for the project that was originally approved for, and you would therefore just be reassigning the use of those bonds to this project.
I just wanted to assure the committee that there's been a lot of discussion of these items in the subcommittee and of Ways and Means during the session, so it's not like it's a new item that's just coming before us. Any questions? For
Department of Administrative Services. We are also recommending approval of the project with the stipulation Mr. Bender indicated that we recommend the transfer of existing Article 11F bonds from the limitation you established during the last session, and also established another $9 million limitation for the funds that the universities and the system are continuing with. As the testimony has indicated, this is phase one of a two-phase project. The second phase would require the use of state bonding, Article 11G bonds in the future. And we have been informed and assured by the system that if that project is not approved, the second phase is not approved, that phase one will give a complete functional building when it is done, regardless of the ultimate determination on phase two. So given those two caveats, we are recommending approval.
The ultimate determination on phase two will be during the coming legislative session.
Potentially.
Mr. Bender.
Mr. Chair and members, LFO also recommends approval of the request modified to transfer the existing Article 11 F1 bond authority for the other Portland State project to this new project. The actual language of our recommendation is shown there in the analysis, and I can get into more detail there. I can read it verbatim if you'd like, but there are certain technical issues involved to assure that the existing bond authority be reallocated to this new project and that the other funds, other revenues limitation also be established.
Any additional questions? Hearing none, do we have a motion? Then I guess the motion would be to accept the LFO recommendation.
I would make that motion, Mr. Chair, and if you wish for the record to read that recommendation or just to...
You can read it if you'd like. It's fine. Actually, go ahead and read it. Just say that.
Motion would be to establish another funds capital construction Article 11F bonds expenditure limitation for Portland State University PCAP block redevelopment phase one project and transfer $42 million from the other funds capital construction Article 11F1 bonds expenditure limitation established for the Portland State University Student Recreation Fitness Center and Housing Project to the newly established expenditure limitation and establish another funds capital construction, which is inclusive of federal funds, expenditure limitation of $9 million for the same PCAT block redevelopment phase one project.
Is there any discussion? Before I go to seeing if there are any objections, I would like to state for the record that there is a party that would normally be here that is not here, and that is Ms. Murdoch. And I think everyone basically knows that Ms. Murdoch unfortunately suffered a stroke and is now recovering. It will probably be a while before we see her back in the Capitol, but I would hope that the President and Vice President would communicate our concern for her health and our wish that she comes back here soon.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll communicate that to her. I saw her on Sunday, and her recovery is going smoothly, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Hearing none, motion passes. We will go on to item 11. Mr. Bender, we may have a member that has to leave in about an hour and 10 minutes. Can we have LFO
start?
An hour and 10 minutes. Okay. If you want to give it.
Sure.
Just a brief on 11.
11 is the first of two capital construction projects on the University of Oregon campus in Eugene. The number 11 is to actually expand a project that the emergency board initially approved in June to improve Hayward Field at the University of Oregon. The request is to expand this project from $7.39 million to $32.39 million.
Mr. Chairman, members, Jay Kenton again, Oregon University System. With me today is Chris Ramey, U of O's Director of University Planning. We're here to request, as Mr. Bender said, that you establish a $32.39 million other funds limitation and authorize the university to spend donations to upgrade Hayward Field. As noted, we were here before you in June, I believe it was, asking for a $7.39 million limitation. Since that time, the university has been asked to host the NCAA championships in addition to the Olympic trials at Hayward Field, and this has stimulated increased donor interest in the project. We're therefore asking to expand that limitation to recognize the university's ability to spend whatever donations they get for that purpose and upgrade the Hayward Field. I'll let Chris elaborate on that a little if you'd like.
Thank you, Jay. Chair Devlin, members of the subcommittee, thank you for agreeing to listen to us this morning. As Jay mentioned, I'm Chris Ramey, the university's architect and director of facilities planning. When we were here in June, we explained that the Olympic trials was a probably once-in-a-generational opportunity to showcase the state of Oregon, the University of Oregon, and certainly even the region. It's a wonderful event, but it does take facilities improvements, and we think we've found interested donors who are willing to participate in this project. We've also added, as Jay mentioned, the 2010 NC2A championships, also an event that will bring national attention and prestige to the area. Today we're asking simply to expand upon an earlier approved project if indeed we are able, fortunate enough to find donors who are interested, and we think we do have them. We'd like to do a better job and more of the things we mentioned in June. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Mr. McGee.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee from Department of Administrative Services. We recommend you approve the request.
Mr. Bender.
LFO also recommends approval of the request and notes that if you do approve this, this would not create any obligations on the general fund either now or in the future.
Do we have a motion?
Mayor.
Okay. We have a motion to approve the request. Are there any objections? There are no objections. Motion passes. Senator Morris, would you carry?
Sure. Well, I'm a beaver. I'll be honored to do that.
Well, we won't talk about football. It's not a good
thing. That's okay. I'd be happy to.
Okay.
I like the outcome. Right, Senator?
Yes. I'll exercise the chair's prerogative and we'll move on to item number 12.
Item number 12 is the second capital construction project at University of Oregon. It's actually for the acquisition of or the purchase of the Romania property in Eugene, which is adjacent to the U of O campus. The institution is requesting authority to purchase this property essentially from their foundation.
Mr. Chair, members, again, Jay Kenton, Oregon University System, and Chris Ramey, University of Oregon Planning Director. We're here to request that you establish a $5.7 million other funds project limitation and authorize the University of Oregon to purchase the old Romania dealership and associated lots on Franklin Boulevard in Eugene. As noted by Mr. Bender, in 2005, the U of O Foundation purchased this property and leased it to the university. The university now would like to purchase the property in order to avoid increased costs associated with carrying the property. The University of Oregon Foundation would have to refinance it, and also it's currently on the property tax rolls that would come off if purchased by the university. Funding for the purchase comes from proceeds from the sale of the Westmoreland housing facility, and this is entirely consistent with what the university had always indicated in their plans to the Board of Higher Education. The project was reviewed and approved by the State Board of Higher Ed at their November 3rd, 2006 meeting. I'll let Mr. Ramey add in.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Kenton, and again, Chris Ramey, the architect, Chairman Javelin, members of the subcommittee. This is a very important property purchase to the University of Oregon. As you may know from the University's Oregon campus, we are surrounded by a developed community. This really allows the university to create a legacy for the future by purchasing a very large tract of land that is practically adjacent to the campus. So it's an important strategic move for the university, something that will set the university and the state in good standing for many decades to come and allow us to expand when we need to. I don't have much more to add than that. Thank you very much for your time.
Any questions? Seeing none, Mr. McGee.
Chair Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services, we recommend you approve the request.
Mr. Bender.
LFO also recommends approval.
Any additional questions, or do we have a motion?
So made.
It has been moved to approve the request. Are there any objections? Hearing none, motion passes. Representative Krupp, will you carry?
Be happy to, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go Ducks.
Go Ducks. They did last night.
They played very well. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my radio station is the official station of the Ducks. So, it was with some heartbreak that I say that.
Okay. Can I blame at least one of the losses? Okay. Please come forward from the agency. This is the item on fee remissions. Mr. Bender, will you give a brief?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Last session, the legislature removed a cap on fee remissions that had been in place, which had limited programmatic fee remissions to no more than 8% of tuition revenues. At the time that this cap was eliminated, a budget note directed the department to come back to the emergency board and to JLAC as well, and to report on the impacts of eliminating this cap. Fee remissions, of course, are tuition discounts that are provided to students to reduce the cost of attending an Oregon University system institution. A number of findings came back from the report. We've outlined some of those here, and the department will be reporting on the impacts of eliminating this fee remission cap.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you. My name is Neil Bryant. I'm a consultant for the university system, and on my right is Glenn Nelson. It's my privilege to introduce Glenn. He's the assistant vice chairman for budget and finance, vice chancellor, the position that Nancy Heiligman formerly held. And you remember Nancy. She was stolen by Oregon State University and now works primarily for them. And also I'd like to introduce Linda Brady. Linda is the new Senior Vice President and Provost at the University of Oregon, and she's here in case you have questions concerning the fee remission program at the University of Oregon. So, Linda, welcome. We reported the same report to JLAC and had a very good discussion about fee remissions and enrollment in general. As you know, it's been flat in the university system this last year. Community colleges are actually down. It was the experience of the university system as they offered need assessment. Not all those need fee remissions were accepted. For a variety of reasons, the students decided not to go to that university. They went somewhere else, or because of the job market, maybe they stayed in employment rather than going into debt and going to school. But it presents an interesting challenge to the universities, the community college, the legislature on how to motivate more students to attend, and I know we'll have further discussions about that. The university system believes that the fee remission program is important. Our studies show that if you can offer a student at the right time $1,000 towards helping them with their tuition, it sometimes makes the decision for them as to whether or not they'll attend. We appreciate the legislature taking the cap off. It was anticipated that the universities would probably go above the cap, and so the request was, let's have a report to see what that impact is. As Mr. Bender said, we didn't go above 8% for a variety of reasons. Very close, but it didn't exceed it. But we still thought the report was important. And while fee remissions declined slightly from 7.8% to 7.6% of the undergraduate need-based fee remissions, the amount generally, the percentage was about 69.6%. And the need-based awards that were given actually increased from an average of $1,559 to $1,765. And then there was a question about if the legislature heads towards the shared responsibility program, how will that affect fee remissions? Well, in that program, your fee remission would be on the student side of the ledger. They would get credit for that. And we still think even if that program is adopted, you're going to need senior missions. They're going to remain an important part of students making their decision of if to attend and where to attend. So with that, I'll stop, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do you have anything to add? Or are you just here to answer questions?
Just here to answer questions.
Are there any questions from the committee? I would state for the record that we very much appreciate the report, and I think that the actions that were taken in the last session were well-founded. But I would like to just make it clear that to the Chancellor's office that I believe that there will still be questions about fee remissions in the next session.
We anticipate those. It'll be continuing.
Yes, Senator Morse.
A question with respect to the competitive nature of our system versus other systems, noting in the record that other systems grant an average of 17%+, and we're approximately 10% less. Is that a reflection of our lack of basic state support, which does not allow the institutions to provide that additional assistance to students in a competitive way?
Yes.
And it puts our institutions at a disadvantage with respect to other institutions.
Correct. There is an expense when you offer a student either merit or need-based fee remission, and you're limited by your own budget at the individual campuses how much you can spend in that direction. So it's directly related. And it's also limited by, you know, how much tuition you charge. Last time there was a cap of 3%. And the university system naturally stayed within that, but that then also technically would be a reduction in possible fee remissions if you had a higher tuition rate.
Any additional questions? Seeing none. Mr. McGee.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee from DAS. We recommend you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Mr. Bender.
LFO also recommends that you acknowledge the receipt of the report. Notes that some of the findings were unexpected compared to the budget that was approved during the assessment. The fee remission levels were not at the levels that were anticipated in the budget. The report can explain some of the reasons why fee remissions were less than anticipated, but we believe it does not fully the lower level of fee remissions.
Any additional questions? Is there a motion to accept the report?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morse has moved to accept the report or acknowledge receipt of the report. Any objections? Hearing none, motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will be at ease for about 20 to 50 seconds until we get another Representative Scott will carry.
Okay. Certainly, Mr. Chair. Item number 20 is a request from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for you to increase its other funds expenditure limitation to allow expenditure of grant funds that were not anticipated when you passed their budget last session.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dennis Johnson, the Executive Director of the Student Assistance Commission, and I was not here to assemble this budget, but this is a kind of fortunate challenge to have. When the budget was assembled, a certain amount of private fundraising was anticipated, and that's a major kind of activity for us at the Commission. We have a large number of private funds that we administer in addition to the public programs. In this case, what we're looking for is approval to be able to spend the grant proceeds that we have raised for outreach activities throughout the state of Oregon. These outreach activities will help us to get more students into the higher education process. There is a definite shortage of guidance services for students throughout the state of Oregon, and we meet that need or attempt to meet that with our outreach program that this year is in 83 Oregon high schools. We were in 74 of them last year. Our private partners support that, have urged us on, encouraged us to expand that outreach as much as possible, and We're asking for permission to do that with private dollars. We, of course, have no limitation for the funds that we can raise for direct payments to students, the special payments, the scholarships and grants. But for this kind of activity, to even have somebody working on a limited duration contract that would be part of a school year to do some of this outreach for us, this requires special permission. The total request is $166,300, and it comes from several different grant sources. I can certainly give you more detail, but you might just glaze over with that much.
Any questions? Seeing none. Mr. McGee.
Chair, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services, we recommend you approve the request.
Any questions for Mr. McGee? Mr. Kendrick.
Mr. Chair, we also recommend that you approve the request, and we note that approval of these expenditure of these grant funds would not impose any obligation on the general fund either now or in the future.
If there are not any questions, is there a motion?
So made, Mr. Chairman.
It's been moved to approve the request. Are there any objections? Hearing none, motion passes. We will... I'll take it. We are going to move off the agenda slightly, and we're going to move to item number 4. Bureau of Labor of Industries prevailing wage rate. Commissioner Gardner, would you please come forward?
It's trying to get a little lower.
It is. Because you paid them off. Bluetooth. Whoa, awesome.
Joined the board.
It is the 21st century.
No, but so like 7 though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And as you recall, at the September 21st meeting of your subcommittee, I was asked to come back and give a report on prevailing wage and progress toward resolution in the area of public-private partnerships. With me today is Bob Shiprack with the Oregon Construction and Building Trades. And let me outline first a little bit about what's going on with PDC, and then Bob can tell you a little bit about what's going on with housing and how things have progressed with some negotiations with housing as well. First of all, with PDC, they have already held 3 meetings, public meetings, on the public-private partnership. Their 4th is scheduled for December the 6th, where I give a report, and we have an apprenticeship roundtable. There have been a lot of good discussions. We believe they're coming toward resolution. At the moment, it looks like they'll have at least the outline for that at their December 6th meeting, and final resolution as early as early January. And we hope still, I'm cautiously optimistic that whatever comes out of there, we can then bring to the legislature to adopt. And with that, if there's also several other things outlined in the letter. With that, if Bob can outline what's going on with housing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades Council. I'll try and be as brief and to the point as possible. With the, let's call it the task force that the commissioner appointed failing to come up with a final answer on public-private partnerships, several of us recognized that something had to be done nonetheless, and so I kind of took it on myself to start with the housing component of all of this public-private stuff. There are 2 components. One is residential housing, or commonly called affordable housing, is what we usually would find in this area, and then what we call the commercial stuff. Dan has asked me to talk about the housing. It was my pleasure to try and broker a deal on the housing stuff because I'm actually an officer in a community development corporation Our Community Development Corporation has developed four affordable housing projects around the state. I have a little bit of background in this, and I was frankly mortified to see that the housing community was crossways with the commissioner and labor and others on this issue of prevailing wages. I called together a group of known as the AOCDO, which is about 60 CDCs representing the entire state, and then about 20 CDCs, Community Development Corporation. These are private nonprofits representing the metropolitan area, and that's the Community Development Network. I did a little research and found out that my counterpart in California 2 years ago passed legislation through the California legislature dealing with this very subject, and as we've all done in the past, you know, see what other states have done. I got a copy of the legislation, showed it to the housing folks. It seemed to work well for what we were trying to accomplish. The details of the plan are simply this. We identified, first of all, what are public funds, and that was actually pretty easy. We then took a look through this language as to what projects then would be exempted from prevailing wage. And the goal of this was to make a very bright line standard. If this is accomplished, any one of us in this room could probably determine what is a public-private partnership and should wages be applied or not. Anything at 60% of median income, which is how affordable housing is done, you usually have 30% of median, 60%, 80%, or what we call market rate, whatever the jurisdiction is trying to get. Anything 60% or less would be exempted from state prevailing wage. And I want to make it clear because it gets very confusing. Oregon doesn't have a prevailing wage necessarily for housing. We adopt what are known as the HUD rates. These are federal Davis-Bacon residential rates. They are very, very low. Many of them have not been increased since 1979. An electrician, for instance, on a HUD project makes about $11 an hour and no fringes. That's the prevailing wage. Nobody, trust me, works at that kind of money. So once we got past all of that, things began to go. So we've exempted all of that under the 60% of median. Then we looked at specific things that have been a problem for the labor commissioner, such as transitional housing for drug and alcohol treatment. It's not their homes, but people do sleep there, and under the federal definition, those are called an institution. Well, we all know there are 8, 10, 12 units of housing with some beds. The fact that the bathroom is at the end of the hall shouldn't be the determining factor here. So we went ahead and exempted certain things that just made some sense, again, following much of what the California legislature has done. We are, Annette Talbot, the attorney deputy director for DAN, is in the process of putting language together. We have talked to legislative council. We hope to have the bill introduced, this January. I'm looking for co-sponsors. It has the enthusiastic support of the housing community, and they intend to help us with the legislation. And I'll just stop there and give that's my report on where we're at with the housing thing, and we hope to settle this once and for all and provide a clear, bright line standard for government people, private nonprofits, and workers, for that matter, to know whether or not these rates apply on these specific projects. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just say that, you know, as Bob outlined, our goal at both of the Bureau, with the building trades, with the housing folks, with the community development corporations, has always been to brighten that line and make it a clear, bright line. And we're making steady progress on that. Hope to have a bill all together for you by early part of January.
Are there any questions for the Commissioner, for Mr. Shipwright?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would express appreciation for the sense of urgency and, mm-hmm. and movement to find solutions. You'll recall we had a rather robust discussion at our last emergency board request for funding for legal support. I guess my question, and thank you, Mr. Commissioner, for you, and Bob, for your efforts. What impact do you think this legislation will have on that request for additional Attorney General expense?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we're already well into that additional expense at this moment in time. I don't think that there'll be any effect on that particular request. My hope is that with the passage of legislation in January within it, it won't even take effect till January 1st of 2008. So I would hope within a year after that, with that brighter, clearer line, that, you know, there'd be a lot less need for predeterminations. There'd be a lot less, you know, complaints for us to investigate. But again, that's something that's going to take a year after January 2008 to even see what that effect is. I would hope that's what it'd be, but...
Thank you.
Yes. Senator Schrader.
I would hope you try and quantify that effect, though, given the appropriate timeline, so that we can have a good outcome that we can measure. But time frame is smart. I mean, you want to make sure you be realistic, but I would hope you do that, Dan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader will be sure to do that. One step at a time. We got to get the bill first.
Gotcha.
Any additional questions? Let's see. Ms. Kleiner.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Erica Kleiner with the Department of Administrative Services, we recommend that you acknowledge and receive the report.
Yes, Ms.
Malone. Mr. Chair, members, the Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Are there any additional questions for anyone? Is there a motion?
I shall move.
Senator Morris has moved to accept the report. Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, motion passes. Senator Morris, will you carry?
Certainly.
Mr. Deister will be next.
Okay.
We'll stand at ease for another 20 seconds here. No, that's fine. Mr. Chief Justice, please proceed. Oh, before you do, Mr. Chief Justice, Ms. Lamont, could you just give a brief overview?
Yes, we are on item number 5, and it is a request for an allocation from the General Purpose Emergency Fund for costs for sign and spoken language interpreters. The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending that allocation be deferred to the next legislative session and be a special purpose appropriation for a couple of reasons. One has to do with the status of the emergency fund. The other has to do with a need to take a look at interpreter costs in the court system. We have not only judicial department issues involving this, but also public defense services costs involving this. So that's the recommendation.
Ms. Chief Justice, before we start, for the committee to understand what's going on, is that we have this item before us. There's been a request made to have an interpreter here, and as everybody can see, the interpreter is here. It is not normal at these types of meetings to actually have public testimony, but we received a number of requests. So what we've decided to do is to allow one person to come forward from the deaf community to make a short presentation after the Chief Justice, and then we will go on to the item. But at this point, Mr. Chief Justice, please present the item.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul DeMunez, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. We are requesting that the Emergency Board provide a supplemental allocation of $1,657,462 from the General Purpose Emergency Fund to cover a projected shortfall in the Judicial Department's mandated payments programs. The shortfall is due to the increasing need and accompanying expenditures for in-court interpretation for non-English-speaking individuals. As you know, ORS 45.273 provides, it is declared to be the policy of this state to secure the constitutional rights and other rights of persons who are unable to readily understand or communicate in the English language because of a non-English speaking cultural background or a disability, and who, as a result, cannot be fully protected in administrative and court proceedings unless qualified interpreters are available to provide assistance. It's the duty of the judicial branch to fully implement that legislative mandate. Historically, fully implementing ORS 45.273 has proven difficult. That is so because over the last three biennia, the budget in this area has been reduced sharply. It was reduced during the 2002 special session and again in 2003-2005 due to the revenue crisis facing the general fund in those years. At the end of the 2003-05 biennium, interpreter expenditures exceeded the appropriated level. OJD managed by cutting costs in the jury program and improved the scheduling of interpreters to minimize costs. Even with those cost-cutting measures, OJD still had to supplement the mandated payments budget with operation funds. This biennium, expenditures have outpaced our appropriation from the start. Mandated payments for interpreter services has increased 25% over the last biennium. The driving force behind this increase has been the use of Spanish interpreters in the courts. Spanish interpreter costs have increased 34% over the last biennium and account for approximately 40% of the total interpreter costs. The increase in interpreter costs can be traced to two areas. First, compliance, and second, demand. As courts have been brought into compliance with the standards set by OJD performance measures, costs have increased. We estimate that a small portion, probably less than 25% of the budget shortfall, can be traced to increased compliance. Also, compliance with the ADA has increased cost as well, and we have seen a significant increase in the cost of providing interpreters for deaf jurors, litigants, and spectators. Then there's demand. Oregon continues to see a significant and steady increase in the number of Spanish-speaking residents who speak limited or no English. Other populations of non-English speakers, for example, Vietnamese, Russian, are increasing at an even higher rate, though the total population of those languages combined is far less than Oregon's Spanish-speaking population. In my view, however, that does not fully answer the question. And if I were sitting in your place, I would have questions about why is the demand now outstripping the resource. I have no particular study to support me, but I have these observations based on my own research and my contact with the Spanish-speaking community. And I'll offer these for what you might deem them to be worth in this area. Historically, single male migrant workers came to Oregon for relatively brief periods of time, following an agriculturally based circuit over several states and returning to their home country annually. I can verify that because over 17 years ago I represented a migrant worker from Oaxaca in a very well-known, still today, a well-known case, and I was able to literally contact witnesses in that case 4 years later because of the circuit that those witnesses and those people traveled. That's changed today. It's not the same. Fortification of the border has resulted in many Spanish speakers staying in Oregon permanently, and historical migration patterns and trends have almost been eliminated. Male Spanish speakers whose families historically remained behind in their home country have increasingly brought their families to Oregon or established families here. That has increased our caseload, especially in the realm of juvenile, dependency, and domestic cases. There have also been dramatic increases in immigrants from southern Mexico and indigenous regions such as Oaxaca. In 2001, court interpreter services saw an average of 8 to 10 cases involving speakers of indigenous languages per year. In 2006, we've had an average of 8 to 10 cases per week. This is the, quote, canary in the coal mine indicator of the massive influx of both Spanish speakers and indigenous language speakers from the state areas of southern Mexico. Finally, people who speak limited or no English are generally highly represented in the judicial system in comparison to those English speakers of the same ethnicity. Populations with limited English also tend to make less money, another factor which may contribute to those populations that are highly represented in this area. In any event, we are required to fully implement the legislative policy expressed in ORS 45.273, and our projection indicates that a supplemental allocation is necessary in order to provide those services until the end of the biennium. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for the Chief Justice? Thank you very much.
Thank you. There is one party that has requested to testify, and they will have 3 minutes to testify. If they would please come forward.
I want to thank you for allowing me to testify about the funds allocated to interpreters. I'm deaf, that's obvious, and a couple years ago I had some legal problems. Well, I was going to have my daughter in the custody of me, and if it hadn't have been for the fact that the state had paid for an interpreter, I probably would have lost. And obviously, I would be sitting there twiddling my thumbs if I didn't have an interpreter. And I think I can speak for not only deaf folk, but also I can speak for all of those whose language is not English. And it's very, very important, because we all have a constitutional right to due process. And I think that providing an interpreter goes along with that. So I request that you would continue the funding for interpreting, because I'm a deaf consumer, and I can speak from first-hand experience. That is very, very important to provide interpreters, not just for COVID, in any situation, medical or whatever. But I know that this issue is related in court. And I just want to thank you for allowing me to say my short speech. And please do. I implore you to continue with the funding. People's jobs are at stake, and definitely all rights are at stake. To me, it's a civil rights issue also, as well as a monetary issue.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Chief Justice, we
have to identify him for the record, Mr. Chief.
Yes. Can you please come forward one more time? My good colleague to the right reminded me that we need to have you identify yourself for the record, just your name and where you're from.
My name is Wendell, W-E-N-D-E-L-L, last name Goff, G-O-F-F, and I'm from Salem.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chief Justice, please come forward.
Mr. Chief Justice, I actually only did have one question. The increase in costs are basically from the general purpose appropriation. There is not actually very much money left in terms of the general purpose dollars available. And in fact, if it wasn't for the fact that we could free up dollars at this particular juncture in the biennium, there probably wouldn't be any dollars available. There are some items in here that indicate that it's very difficult for the Judicial Department to actually track some of these costs, because actually they're provided in numerous different ways, and obviously numerous different facilities, and obviously you don't want to make individual judgments for your jurists about whether or not an interpreter is needed. But what are you looking at in terms of trying to address that issue of being able to track the cost? Because if it wasn't for some just things happening right now, we might not even have the money to actually fund this.
Well, I agree that we need to be able to account for
the use of interpreters on a case-by-case basis at some point. And I have two responses to that. One is a little bit off this subject, but I hope you'll indulge me. Since I became Chief Justice, I have been attempting to wrench the judicial branch of government technologically out of the 20th century and into the 21st century. We don't have a person-based case. We don't have a person-based case management system now. We have a case register system. That contributes to the inability to track the individual use of interpreters. Second of all, it's very common, and of course this varies from county to county, but it's very common, for example, in arraignments. I don't know if any of you have ever attended an arraignment, but it would be very common to arraign, for example, 30 or 40 individuals in a span of an hour and a half. And those arraignments, there might be 20 of them that require interpreter assistance. And so those can't be tracked to individual cases because of the speed with which that has to occur to keep the docket on track. And so they just get recorded as the use of that interpreter that particular day. So I think we have to do a better job eventually in tracking that information. That's a difficult situation. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Are there any additional questions for the Chief Justice?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Morris.
If we might explore in a little greater detail the last sentence in the LFO finding, which reads, the Justice Department has the ability to temporarily maintain the program through its general budget until a supplemental appropriation is approved.
Ms. Lamont.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they can use their general fund appropriation as long as there's an understanding that the requirement will not be that they permanently supplant some other activity. All I was trying to say is that, yes, they need the allocation, but that it can be deferred, that they have some resources that they could temporarily use.
And our intent here, in my understanding of discussions, is that the intent with LFO is that there will be probably a supplemental appropriations bill sometime in March to deal with a number of issues in various budgets, which would be relatively normal.
And we'd have the information we've asked from OJD and other agencies to make that a reality.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you're going to have several issues in front of you this morning that involve a full or partial deferral of costs. So there is an expectation that there will be a bill that will be run through fairly early in the session to make sure that there isn't a shortfall and a disruption to this service.
Providing the information we requested.
Yes. Okay. Is that satisfactory, Senator?
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, please. From the administrative service.
Actually, I'm Kingsley Click, for the record, State Court Administrator.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members, the Department of Administrative Services does not make
recommendations
by judicial branch agencies.
I apologize for that. It's been a while.
Separation of powers issue there. I think
he's new to the legislature.
I won't say anything. Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, I was just going to respond to LFO's answer. So you have the mandated payments is the entire appropriation, and the interpreters are a line item within it, and we did estimate the whole fund could at least get through April, so that did give sufficient time to deal with it, and that would take care of the immediate this month's payments.
Are there any questions? Do we have a motion?
So made, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Crump has moved to defer the request until the 2007 legislative session. Is there any additional questions or comments? Are there any objections? Hearing none, motion passes. We will go. Senator Schrader, I haven't picked on you yet.
I'd love to take this, Mr.
We will go on to the next item. Mr. Mott.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Judicial Department is requesting that you acknowledge receipt of a report on the state court facilities account and increase the other funds expenditure limitation by $1,112,043 to continue implementation of court security. There was commentary in the budget report that directed that or indicated that the department would develop a plan and return to the emergency board.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul DeMunez, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. We're here to provide a report on the plans for the expenditure of funds collected for the state court facilities security account. We are requesting that the committee acknowledge receipt of the report and increase the Judicial Department's other fund expenditure limitation of $1,112,043 to enable the Judicial Department to carry out that plan. In 2005, the legislature authorized an other fund expenditure of $159,823 to begin enhancing security at the Supreme Court building and other facilities used by the Court of Appeals, Tax Court, and the Office of the State Court Administrator. When I became Chief Justice in January 2006, I initiated an immediate security improvement plan at the Supreme Court building. We now have a security officer at the public entrance to the Supreme Court building, installed security cameras, and blast protected our windows. There is, however, much more to do at the Supreme Court and the other sites that the Court of Appeals, Tax Court, and State Court Administrator occupy. There is also much to do throughout the state in all of the courthouses in Oregon. On March 11, 2005, a criminal defendant on trial in the Fulton County Courthouse in Atlanta, Georgia, killed a security officer, a court reporter, and a judge. In November 2005, a man drove his pickup truck at 100 miles an hour up the Marion County Courthouse steps and through the front door. In 4 hours, that man, armed with a shotgun, a handgun, and 5 gallons of gas, completely destroyed the interior of a 5-story courthouse. Those two events that I've just described should leave no doubt that we have an obligation to court personnel, judges, and the public who visit our courthouses in large numbers daily to do everything within our power to make courthouses as safe and secure as possible, and that we have fully operational business continuity and emergency preparedness plans for every court operation in every county in the state. In October of this year, Doris Downs, the Chief Judge of the Fulton County Superior Court, spoke for 2 hours to our presiding judges throughout the state. She emphasized that it's not enough to have a security plan. You must actually engage in extensive training and practice under the plan for it to have any effect. On March 11, 2005, in Atlanta, they had a plan, but not a single aspect of that plan was ever implemented. In my view, two factors contributed to the failure to implement any aspect of that plan in Atlanta. First, there had been no actual practice of the plan. The second reason is related to the first. Security in the courthouse involves multiple agencies and organizations. All of those agencies must be integrated into a plan and must be part of an integrated training scheme. In my view, the goal of securing the judicial branch and ensuring the continuous delivery of judicial services in the event of a disaster is a formidable undertaking and will require several years to complete. We appear today to seek approval for what I consider to be the first steps of a series, for the first time, of strategic initiatives designed to evaluate court facilities throughout the state, conduct interagency planning with courts, counties, and law enforcement, implement and test enhanced security and preparedness plans, and conduct comprehensive training for court security officers, court staff, and courthouse users. The initial steps in our plan cover the remaining 7 months of the present biennium. In the training and education module, we propose holding 2 additional court security officer training programs. The pilot model of that program is being held today in conjunction with the Oregon Sheriff's Association. We also propose a security response training program that will be videotaped and sent to court facilities and made available throughout the circuit courts of this state. The physical evaluation, collaborative planning, and implementation modules in this initiative have 2 parts. In the first part, we propose engaging a firm to review the court security and emergency preparedness plans submitted by circuit courts pursuant to Oregon Laws Chapter 808. In addition, we propose contracting for site evaluations of several court facilities this biennium and completing those evaluations in the 07-09 biennium. This first track will provide comprehensive and objective evaluation of all circuit court sites and their security plans. In the second part, our goal is to work with 3 pilot sites to strategically plan and integrate new security, emergency preparedness, and business continuities within the county courthouses. We propose engaging a consultant to work collaboratively with these circuit courts to develop strategic plans, which then will be implemented and tested in the biennium. The focus of this initiative is to work interdependently, and I'd like to emphasize that. We need to work interdependently with court, county, and law enforcement officials to design and implement plans that meet the needs of all the stakeholders in the court facilities. Our research has indicated that the judicial departments in Maryland and New Jersey have been engaged in this type of integrated and interdependent planning with significant success. We plan on utilizing this collaborative methodology in the balance of the judicial districts the next biennium. At the appellate level and the administrative level, we require supplemental expenditure authority to continue security enhancements at the Supreme Court building. These include design and installation of intrusion barriers at the State Street entrance, upgraded exterior lighting, and additional installation of monitoring cameras. When the construction of the DAS-owned Justice Building is completed in the spring of 2007, we will require significant resources to evaluate and upgrade security systems at that site for the Court of Appeals and the Office of the State Court Administrator. The estimates for the initial upgrades are in your materials. After construction, and after we've had an opportunity to inspect the building and conduct a complete site evaluation with the Oregon State Police, we will have additional needs to address. Although our limitation request is significant, the challenge before us is also significant. Our approach is based on a strategy of first assessing the varying needs of a diverse judicial community, some as large as Multnomah County, and some as small as Grant County. We must work with our county and law enforcement partners to evaluate security needs and collectively plan and implement those solutions. This is a long-term strategy that will require long-term financial commitment. The plan we are presenting to you today begins that process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice. Are there any questions for the Chief Justice? Senator Schrader.
How are you going to measure the success of this investment? What are your outcomes going to be?
Very good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader. I think the way to measure this, and again, I'm not a security expert, although I feel a personal obligation for every person who comes into those courthouses, I think we have to start with the training module. That, in other words, the actual training process, the actual practicing, this is the one part that we were, at least I felt, the best information we got from Judge Downs is you can test those outcomes by practice, and that nobody has practiced much. And that is where I think we'll be able to set our parameters and measure our outcomes by actually performing those practices. And I'll also defer if the state court administrator has a comment about that.
It's just if I may, Mr. Dr. Belaber, if I would hope that you'd work collaboratively maybe with some of the people in LFO and other that are used to developing outcomes. Now, this is an area where hopefully it's a zero. You know, you don't want anything to happen.
Right.
But it'd be interesting to know what the experience has been in the other state and, you know, what your goal would be. And that would, I think, help us feel comfortable about the investment long-term, track those results, and adjust things as needed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, that's a very good observation. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Crump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chief Justice, I want to applaud you for going aggressively in this direction. It's something that I think has been, we've been behind the eight ball on this, and we need to play catch-up now in many ways. One of the things that I'm also glad to hear you talk about is practicing what plans you have in place today and plans you will develop in the future. I spent 12 years in the fire service, and we drill every week. Full-time paid firefighters drill every day to make sure that your plans and your policies and procedures can be implemented effectively when they need to be. And I would also say that I've served on the Emergency Preparedness Committee here at the joint level, Senate and House, and then also on a National Homeland Security Task Force. And this issue of disaster issues and the ability of the courts to function is a critical element of maintaining some semblance. There will be a recommendation to you all in the next legislative session for a very broad and sweeping discussion and potential offering of constitutional amendments for the people to vote on regarding this issue of a continuity of government, whether on the legislative side. For instance, what happens if we have a major terrorist attack, a pandemic of flu, and the legislature needs to meet, but we don't have enough legislators to meet under our current constitutional requirements for a quorum? How do we deal with that? Same thing is true with the court system. These are questions that really need to be dealt with to some extent for planning in the future. So I'm glad that you're moving in that direction and hope that you have a plan for major disasters of how to make the Supreme Court and the appellate courts work in addition to, and that's why I'm glad to hear you also working at the local level with the circuit courts. This is a critical element it's got to be addressed all across the nation. And the second thing I would say to you all as members of this committee, you will be here, I will not, in the next session. I'll be sitting out there. I want you to also consider the same reasons the Chief Justice has gone aggressively after this issue. I want you to consider in this building, Congress has had to address security issues at a higher level than what we have. The courts are doing it. The incident here at the Marion County Courthouse is a prime example of why I believe we are also behind the eight ball in security protocols in this building, as good as the state police are. I want you to pay particular attention to that and look at enhancing our security here in the next legislative session. I am fearful that something will happen in the future and that we will regret not having taken a more aggressive posture in the future. So, Mr. Chief Justice, I applaud you and your directions, and I wholeheartedly support this request.
Any additional comments? Hearing none. Ms. Kingsley Clark, do you have anything to add?
Chair,
and for the sake of the staff around me and members and the people in the audience, I'm being assisted by pharmaceuticals, but I'm not contagious. Please proceed.
That's funny for you, Mr. Chair.
For the record, State Court Administrator, Mr. Chair, I'm just up here in case there were some technical questions or past history questions. Chief Justice presented all the basic facts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have a motion?
So made, Mr. Chairman.
I
And Ms. Lamont, anything additional?
Well, I just wanted to point out, because there was extensive discussion when the bill was in front of Ways and Means about the fact that the funds are being collected on assessments on all courts, and that there was direction that the security planning would deal with all courts, and by that I mean in addition to the circuit courts, the municipal and justice courts, and point out that the Chief Justice has reconvened the Task Force on Special Courts, which is the municipal and justice courts, and that this is going to be one of the topics under consideration by that task force.
Okay. There is a motion on the floor. Thank you, Representative Crump. Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Crump, will you carry?
Yes, I'd be honored. Thank you.
Do you want us to wait?
Do you have public service? We'll go here first. Okay. Will the whoever is going to be here for public defense services please come forward?
Since this is another judicial branch agency without any recommendations from Department of Administrative Services, let me briefly describe what this issue entails. The Public Defense Services Commission was in front of you at the last emergency board with a request for $7.8 million to cover unanticipated costs for representation during this biennium. The September emergency board allocated $3.9 million and directed them to return to this meeting of the emergency board. The request is for an additional $3.9 million, the other half of that request. The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending that $2,944,875, which is 75% of the request, be allocated, with the understanding that they will come forward with a supplemental appropriation of $981,625 to cover the remainder of the cost.
Okay. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Ingrid Swenson, and I am the newly appointed Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. With me this morning is Catherine Aylward. She's the Director of our Contract and Business Services Division and the person responsible for the preparation of our budget. As Ms. Lamont indicated, we were here in September seeking a total of $7.85 million to cover an anticipated shortfall in our 2005-2007 budget. As we explained at that time, when we projected our future funding needs, we used the non-death penalty trial level caseload as the measure and assumed that our other costs would rise proportionally. We were extremely accurate about the rate of increase in the trial-level non-death penalty caseload. However, the other costs turned out not to be proportional to the increase for that caseload. And briefly, there were three major areas in which growth exceeded our projections. The first of those was the number of appellate cases in the system. It increased substantially and disproportionately to the trial-level caseload. That was due to a number of factors, but one of them was two Supreme Court decisions, which could not have been anticipated. One, the Crawford decision, which affected the evidence, which is admissible in some criminal cases. And the second was the Blakely decision, which affected sentencing in all felony cases. The second area of disproportionate increase was in death penalty cases. And although the number of new death penalty cases each year has remained relatively stable, there is a cumulative effect in the death penalty area, because it is rare for those cases to be resolved finally at the trial level. There's almost always going to be an appeal from a trial level decision, a post-conviction petition after the appeal is complete, and usually an appeal from a denial of the post-conviction relief request. Consequently, these costs continue to mount from one biennium to the next. Not only do we have the new cases, but we have the accumulated other cases that remain in the system and require representation throughout. Some of those cases last as long as 20 years in our system. In addition, when the appellate courts and the post-conviction courts remand those cases to the trial court for any reason, some of them start at the very beginning all over again. The third general category of disproportionate increases includes some necessary services for which we've been required to pay more than we have in the past. One of those is legal representation with respect to some kinds of cases, particularly Measure 11 and murder cases. Mileage for investigators because of the increase in costs to those people. Interpreters, again, as you heard from the Chief Justice, there's an increasing number of cases in which either the clients or the witnesses are non-English speaking and require interpreters in order to participate. And then for expert witnesses and consultants whose services in our cases are required either by statute or constitutionally. We've tried to keep these costs down, but those providers are not dependent on us for their livelihoods, and they simply go elsewhere if we can't compensate them adequately. They're already charging us less, significantly less, in some cases than they charge their private clients. But those costs have continued to increase. In September, you approved half of the requested amount, directed us to come back today. We're aware of Legislative Fiscal's recommendation that you approve the 2.9 of the requested additional $3.9 million at this time. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, Ms. Lamont.
Mr. Chair, the recommendation is that the Emergency Board allocate $2,944,875 from the Emergency Fund with the understanding that the 2007 legislature will be requested to provide a supplemental appropriation of $981,625 for the cost for the remainder of the 2005-07 biennium.
Do we have a motion?
Move the LFO recommendations, Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Schrader. It's been moved. Is there any additional discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Senator Schrader, will you take that?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will now stand at ease for a few seconds. Please come forward. We are now back on our regular agenda order. So we're going back to item number 34. We'll go to 34, 35, and then 9. Sorry for the delay.
Certainly. Good morning. Item number 34 is a request by the department, the Employment Department, to accept a report by the Child Care Division on how federal grant funds will be used by the Oregon Environmental Council's EcoHealthy Child Care Program. Back in June, the Employment Department requested retroactive approval to apply for a federal grant from the United States Environmental Protection Agency on behalf of the Oregon Environmental Council's award-winning EcoHealthy Child Care Program. The grant has been awarded, but it has not yet been accepted by the department, pending receipt of this report by the Emergency Board. Employment Department has been working very closely with the Environmental Council and other stakeholders to really address some issues that were brought up at the June meeting with regard to this particular program, and I'll let let them speak to that.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the director for the Oregon Employment Department. I'm here to report on the EcoHealthy Child Care grant that you have before you. As Michelle mentioned, the issue was before the emergency board in June of this year when we asked for the retroactive authority to apply for the grant. That was granted by the emergency board for the $94,000 pass-through grant from the EPA. But the emergency board asked us to return here and answer three questions that the emergency board had if we were awarded the grant. The three questions were how the grant money will be used by the Environmental Council, how many positions would be established associated with the funding, and what information would be provided to the public. This grant replaces and utilized by the Environmental Council for an existing employee who will be focused on expanding the eco-certified child care facilities from the current number of 97 to approximately 300. There will be no new positions established either at the Environmental Council or at the Employment Department, and representatives from the Oregon Environmental Council, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, and the Soap and Detergent Association have been working together to come up with an agreed-upon checklist that would be the basis for the public information. And the document you have in front of you is the agreement that they reached about the language on the 25-point checklist. There were three items that they were in disagreement with in terms of language, and what they have reached agreement at is in the letter in front of you in terms of what that language would be around the use of pesticides as well as cleaning products in the child care centers. The Employment Department will basically be the administrative agent that passes the money through to the Oregon Environmental Council. We will receive quarterly reports that we will then work with the EPA to submit, and we basically do not need expenditure limitation for these funds. We have adequate limitation at this time to administer the grant. Christine McNitt from the Soaps and Detergent Association, Andrea Derman from the Oregon Environmental Council, and Terry Witt from Oregonians for Food and Shelter are here today. If you have detailed questions you want to ask them either about the agreement or about the program, they would be available to do that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be also happy to take any questions you might have.
For the record, in discussions of this item yesterday at the subcommittee chairs meeting, Susan Morgan wanted to ensure that I congratulated all of you, all the people that have worked on this agreement, and that it represents some very good work that was done. So, are there any questions from the committee at this time? Mr. McGee.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend you acknowledge receipt. We recommend you acknowledge receipt of the report.
For as long as they exist, this is DAS. I'm sorry.
The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledgement of receipt of the report.
Do we have a motion?
I move the FO recommendation.
Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Representative Scott, will you carry?
Sure.
Okay. We will now go on to agenda item number 35. Please proceed, Ms.
Okay. Agenda item 35 is a request from the Department of Housing and Community Services to increase federal funds expenditure limitation by $10.5 million due to increased federal allocations, federal program restorations, and revised forecasting associated with several of its federally funded programs. This request is not driving the need for additional other funds expenditure limitation by the department, only its federal funds, and it is basically because for the programs that are listed in the analysis, OH, OHCS is now in a position to make more payments to subgrantees than in years past. That's due to a combination of either an increase in federal funds allocations or, in some cases, the ability of the department to process payments to subgrantees and get more money out the door.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Victor Merced. I'm the newly appointed director of the Department of Oregon Housing and Community Services. To my right is Rick Krager. He's the deputy director for the department and prepared the 05-07 legislatively adopted budget. Basically, our federal funds expenditure limitation request is for four programs. One is for the low-income energy assistance program. This program provides low-income households with home heating costs and is for eligible households that include any whose income is at or below 60% of Oregon's median income with documented energy costs. The additional federal funds limitation of $2.3 million is requested to accommodate the carryover allocation from previous federal fiscal years and increase allocations from DHHS due to rising energy costs. The second program is the Community Development Block Grant, CDBG. This grant is funded by HUD to provide housing rehabilitation grants to low-income households. Our anticipated expenditures of $5.1 million. However, federal funding is projected to exceed that amount by $2.5 million. The third program is a Continuum of Care grant. This grant is funded by HUD and allocated by OHCS to local projects in 26 rural counties that address the multiple challenges faced by the homeless and those folks that are in transitional housing. Federal funding for this program has increased significantly, requiring an increase in federal funds expenditure limitation of $1.5 million. Our fourth program is the Home Investment Partnership and Home Tenant-Based Assistance Program. These programs are funded by HUD to develop affordable housing and to subsidize rental payments for low and very low-income Oregonians. An additional $4.2 million in federal funds is requested to accommodate this additional program activity. The outcomes of for this result of approving this request, the department will be able to provide the following: 531 households with tenant-based rental assistance, 5,600 households with energy assistance payments, 100 single-family homes rehabilitation grants, and 9 additional grants to aid the homeless through transitional housing, shelter, and shelter assistance. Thank you.
Any questions for the agency or the desk?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Lyndon Troseth with the Department of Administrative Services, and we recommend that you approve the request.
The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request.
Are there any questions? Is there a motion?
The LFO.
Okay. Sorry. The LFO request. Okay. Any questions?
Any objections to the motion?
Hearing none, motion passes. We will now go to the Judicial Fitness Commission. Senator Morse, will you carry?
Sure.
Borden, will you give a brief presentation?
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. Before you is item number 9 for the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. The 9-member commission investigates and acts upon complaints of judicial misconduct or disability. It has jurisdiction over justices of the peace, circuit court judges, and appellate court judges, as well as pro tem judicial referees or temporary judges. The commission has a budget for normal operating expense and then an extraordinary budget for expenses related to investigations and prosecutions. The commission has consumed its current extraordinary budget of $27,983 and is using temporarily its normal operating budget to continue investigations and prosecutions. The commission is requesting a general fund allocation of $75,000 for their extraordinary expenditures. Of note, similar to the judicial department, is that this is a judicial branch agency not subject to executive branch budgetary control.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Dick Feeney. I'm a citizen member of the commission. With me is Carolyn Wilkins. Also with me in the audience is Carolyn Wilkins, also a citizen member of the commission. I am a past chairman. Carolyn will be the incoming chairman. With us is Susan Isaacs, who is our executive director. Thank you for the opportunity to appear today. Thank you for considering this request. We're supportive of what the staff has recommended, and we hope that you will agree with that. Thank you very much. Susan can answer any questions if you'd like to about what a caseload is and how the rest of the biennium is seen with this additional emergency allotment. Thank you.
Could you please give whatever presentation that you'd like to give, and also actually comment on the commission itself in terms of all being volunteers? They're obviously all appointed, and what the typical number of cases are that they have to review in each meeting.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Susan Isaacs, executive director of the commission. The commission consists of 9 members, 3 public members, 2 of whom are here today. Those are appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate. We have 3 attorney members, and they are appointed by the Board of Governors of the Oregon State Bar. Then we have 3 judge members, and they are appointed by our Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. They are, as you stated, volunteers. They give generously of their time. The commission meets regularly 6 times per year. And then, of course, if we have any hearings, then we go to the locale where we have to have the hearing. This biennium, we've been to Medford, and then we've also had a hearing in the Portland area, actually Lake Oswego. I did review some statistics in terms of our complaints received that are reviewed by the commission every year. From 1995 through 2006, through 2005, the average is 121. The high was 141, and the low was 107. And to date, I just finished an agenda, we have 119 for 2006. So we're right on track with our average. In contrast to that, we send out information as requested by individuals. We call these complaint packets. They're very helpful for people to understand the commission. They include instructions for filing a complaint. These seem to vary greatly. In 2001, we sent out 371. In 2005, we sent out 212. And then as of the date of my statistics, November 14, we'd sent out 196. And so the commission does keep busy. And I would I have to say, unfortunately, the amount of information we disseminate does not have a correlation to the number of actual prosecutions, because we have no way to anticipate which complaint would result in a prosecution. So I can't draw any kind of corollary from that.
Members of the committee, why I asked for the comment was simply the commission comes before the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means each session, and they fulfill a very, as I think everyone will understand, a very important function. But they have to sift through many, many complaints, most of them not particularly well-founded. But they are there for the few that are well-founded, so that they are not particularly, it's not particularly easy to estimate what their needs are going to be.
And, sir, Mr. Chair, also I answer numerous phone calls, numerous, that also do not translate into actual complaints.
So, Mr. Borden.
The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending an allocation of $61,944 from the Emergency Fund for the Commission's extraordinary expenses. The one proviso about this that's noted in our recommendation is that these are best. This is based on the current caseload before the Commission, and if some of the estimates prove to be low or new cases are investigated
that arise that it will be investigated through the end of the biennium will likely trigger the commission coming back to the 2007 legislature for an additional appropriation.
Are there any questions? Is there a motion?
Sure. I move the LFO request.
Okay. Senator Schrader has moved the LFO request. Any additional comments? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. I will carry.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill, I hear they've been working elsewhere. Please come forward, Department of Education. We will now go through items 16 and then on to 19 and just down the agenda. Mr. Hill, do you want to give a brief overview of item number 15?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. Item number 15 is a request to allocate the remainder of a special purpose appropriation, about $645,000, specifically related to the local option equalization grants. You may remember about two meetings ago, we originally appropriated about half of that money out to for the previous school year. They are now coming in and requesting the money for the current school year.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Sue McGlashan, Assistant Superintendent with the Office of Finance and Administration at the Oregon Department of Education. And as Mr. Hill indicated, we are requesting allocation of the balance of the special purpose appropriation. That would be $646,039, and again, for local option equalization grants for us to distribute to schools in the 06-07 school year. And we do note that LFO recommends allocation of the funds with the understanding that the Department of Administrative Services will unschedule the entire amount until the final amounts are determined and then reviewed by LFO and DAS. And we are in agreement with this approach. We find it very reasonable. The data that we have now is preliminary, and we expect to have final numbers by early next year. And with me is Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent with the Office of Analysis and Reporting at the Department, who can provide you more detail and answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions for Mr. Reeder? Don't see any at this point. Did you have anything to add, Mr. Reeder?
Just to clarify, the reason that that we don't have an exact amount at this point is data from the Department of Revenue on actual taxes imposed for these levies is just now coming into the Department of Revenue and will not be finalized for a couple months. By law, these grants are paid in March, I believe, and so in plenty the Department of Revenue data is ready in plenty of time to make those payments. It simply isn't ready today.
And I think most of the members of the committee understand this. Part of the reason for that is how complex we've made the process for determining what the increment is for each individual property in terms of a local option, what is available. Any additional questions?
Simply a comment, if I may, Mr. Chair, on that issue. I believe that was done mostly by initiative.
Yes. So, and part of it was done by the legislature, but yes, Dennis.
My name is Jim Carboni with Budget Management Division. We do concur with Legislative Fiscal Office's recommendation to unschedule the funds until, in fact, they are determined precisely.
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, LFO recommends that you go ahead and allocate the $646,039 from the special purpose appropriation with it to be unscheduled until final numbers are done. It should be next spring. And that the monies would then be allocated as needed.
Are there any questions for anyone? Is there a motion?
The LFO recommendation, recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Scott. The LFO recommendation has been moved. Any additional questions? Any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections, motion passes. We'll go on to item number 17. I'll take it. Mr. Hill.
Item number 16, is that where we are?
Or 16, I'm sorry.
Okay. Item number 16 is a request to increase federal funds expenditure limitation for the Youth Corrections Education Program and the Juvenile Detention Education Program, mainly because the department has become aware of some unanticipated federal revenues.
Please proceed, Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the subcommittee. Again, Sumit Glashan with the Oregon Department of Education. And we are requesting an increase of $449,837 in our federal funds expenditure limitation for youth corrections and juvenile detention education programs. The two sources of this increase are Title I, D, neglected and delinquent, and then Title II for highly qualified teachers. And we did not anticipate these revenues at the time the 05 Legislative Assembly was in the process of adopting our budget for 05-07. If you have any specific questions on this, I need to warn you that Nancy Latini is the person to ask, and right now she's in the House Education Committee testifying on another issue, but I'd be happy to run down and see if she's available if I can't answer your questions. Thank you.
Any questions at this point? Hearing none, can I have the DAS recommendation?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Carbone again. DAS does recommend approval of this request.
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, we also would recommend that you approve the request.
Move the LFO request.
That's correct. Any additional questions from the committee? Hearing none, are there any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. I will carry. No.
We've done so much homework, Mr. Chair, we understand these issues completely. It's the only reason we're moving rapidly.
Well,
you have a great committee, sir.
Start thinking about the Department of Transportation items. I want them to get worried. Okay, Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, item number 17 is a request by the department to retroactively approve submission of a federal Department of Education grant and to also increase the federal funds limitation of this grant. You may remember last time they came forward requesting this, and the both the subcommittee and the full committee went ahead and delayed this, the approval of the retroactive, the retroactive approval of the grant. Since that time, they have found out that they were actually awarded the grant, and so they are now back asking for the approval, the retroactive approval, and for the limitation for the current biennium portion of the grant.
And
thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the subcommittee. Again, Sumit Glashan for the Oregon Department of Education. Just to briefly describe what the grant funds will be used for, they'll be distributed to districts for materials and training of teachers in the use of a system of educational and behavioral support that helps students make academic progress, and especially students with learning disabilities and behavioral disorders. Our current staff will oversee the grant, and this grant requires no state match or cost sharing.
And for the record, just so I think everyone understands this, this item was delayed in the last meeting of the e-board. A letter was requested to be sent to the department from the speaker and from the president. The letter was sent, and I think you've all received a copy of that. And so that's the point that we're at now. The grant's been received. The funds are very important for our school system. Mr. Hill, what's your recommendation? I'll go to DAS also. Well, I'll go to DAS first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. DAS, Jim Carbone, DAS does recommend approval.
Mr. Chair, LFO also recommends approval of the request.
Move the LFO recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Schrader. Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections, motion passes. I will carry. Since I don't want to do three in a row with Peter, I won't carry the next one. Or more than three. 18. Mr. Hill.
Number 18, Mr. Chair, is a request to increase federal funds expenditure limitation by $1,060,204 for an enhanced assessment grant from the U.S. Department of Education. Back in June of 2006, at that meeting, the department came forward and requested approval to apply. They have since been awarded this amount, and so they are here to ask for the limitation.
Please proceed, Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the subcommittee. I really don't have anything to add to what Mr. Hill said, except that with me is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Assessment and Information Services, and he can provide more detail or answer any questions that you may have on the grant.
Please proceed if you have any comments on the record.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent, Assessment and Information Services. This is an outcomes-based grant, and it has three deliverables, specifically test administration tools and online training modules and a performance tasks or items that kids can be asked by instructors.
The DAS recommendations.
Chair Jim Carboni with DAS does recommend approval of this request.
Okay, Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, LFO also recommends approval of the request.
Do we have a motion?
The LFO recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schrader. Are there any questions for any of the parties? Hearing no questions, are there any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections, motion passes.
Thank you.
Senator Morse, will you carry?
Yes.
Go on to the next item. Item number 19. Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, item number 19 is the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. They are here to, their original request was to increase other funds limitation by $120,000 to cover unanticipated expenses. Since their initial request, I've had some discussions with them, and it seems like some of their issues may still be issues, and I'll let Vicki explain what those are. As you've probably seen, I'm actually recommending an increase of limitation higher than that with an unscheduling back to the $120,000 that we now know. But I'll let Vicki talk about that.
Okay, please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Devlin. Members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, the Director of Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And we're here before you because we've had a series of unexpected expenditures, and some of it's related to our partnership with the Oregon Department of Education, because we handle identifying highly qualified teachers through the licensure aspect of how that's related, but we don't get any other additional funds to do that. So it tends to slow down our workload, and when our workload increases, costs increase. So we had unexpected costs in overtime this year. We had unexpected costs in travel. Our discipline cases are up almost 50%. We have a backlog of about 300 discipline cases, which means our investigators are traveling more because we do investigate statewide. We had a security breach this summer that resulted in a breakdown of our server that we expected to live longer, so we had to purchase that. And we had an unusually high bill to pay on the young case of over $30,000. We started out with a very slight deficit because when the state police raised their fees last year for the fingerprint fees, we had to wait until the legislature got the bill passed that authorized us to increase our fees. So we got some of that money last year during the legislative session, but we weren't able to get our fees increased until into this biennium. So, and finally, because of the increased discipline caseload, and this is one of the primary reasons we're here, our attorney general fees are up, and we will run out of money on that line item sometime, I expect, around the month of February. Our bills are coming in anywhere from $14,000 to $20,000 a month. This is in defense of cases of educators that have behaved poorly, and so we're here respectfully to ask for an increase in our expenditure limitation. And it seemed to make sense to me since we cannot accurately predict what we're going to need to ask that you accept the recommendation of the Legislative Fiscal Office. And then as we need it, if we need it, it can be unscheduled.
One of the questions that I had, Mr. Hill and Ms. Chamberlain, is that...
I can't hear you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. One of the questions that I have is that you're an entirely fee-based agency.
That's correct.
When we see these reports, we don't know actually what your reserves are. So as we allocate more other funds, we don't know how much funds are actually left for you to operate on. So could you please tell us what your current financial position is?
Well, financially, our revenues are up over $500,000, and we predicted for this biennium, and a lot of that has to do with an increased workload that we weren't expecting to have come in. In other words, licensure coming in is up over 8% this summer, and we expect that trend to continue. Additionally, because we had to do some evaluations on highly qualified teachers, we had it. A cash flow in on those evaluation costs, so we have the revenues to cover this.
To what extent have the additional revenues come in from the expedited fee?
The expedited fee. That's up. That expedited fee is up, and there are several explanations. But it is not, let me see. We issued 1,200 expedited licenses this summer as compared to about 800 expedited licenses over usual summers. That's a service for school districts, and I'm just going to be candid with you and tell you exactly what happened, other than life happened. The Beaverton School District and the Hillsborough School District each hired 500 new teachers this year, and they made a lot of their hiring decisions in August. Well, those applications plugged up our usual summer workload. My staff, unbeknownst to me, got very excited about recommending to help people out through the public service rep method. Well, you can always have it expedited. And expediting is a district-requested emergency fee only. And so districts had to say, please expedite that license before we could do it. And the additional revenues that came to the agency that are more than the usual revenues that come to the agency through expedited services were $120,000.
Thank you very much. Any additional questions?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Chair Devlin, I have an idea about that, and the idea would be that we talk to districts, and if districts want to do that and have a license expedited so that they can have a teacher start when they want that, I want to discuss with districts that districts pay it and that it not come out of the applicant's pocket. The legislation arose out of district requests that they have the ability to expedite licenses, and it seems to be falling. Some districts pay and some districts do not, and sometimes it seems equitable if the district wants a service that we consider discussing with districts that they pay it, and that's a future plan to try to mitigate this situation.
As you can probably tell, I've received a number of inquiries about.
Me too.
So I'm not sure I'm on board with that plan, because that's a cost to the taxpayer, and maybe we have to think about sharing the cost, perhaps at best, if we go down that road at all.
I would agree with Senator Schrader. I think that we need to make careful consideration on that, review it very carefully. It's also a benefit to the employee, obviously, that they get to start.
If you might want to comment, Ms. Chamberlain.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, and members of the committee. It's I truthfully do not expect another summer like this summer. For one reason, I've counseled my staff that they're not to advise people to expedite licenses. It should come from the district when the district wants to do it, and they've been well advised that it is not going to happen. The problem is, just for your information, is that all of this occurred in a matter of about 2 weeks, because it was bumping up against the beginning of the school year. It wasn't a trend that grew over the summer. So I've handled it in that way. The other thing, another factor that played in here, is that we've rolled out a program that allows Oregon graduates to get their license in 3 days by having Oregon institutions fast-track their licensure. And what Oregon institutions are doing for our new college graduates is they're verifying all their licensure requirements, and we're auditing that those materials are valid. That allows us, based on the college's recommendation alone, to issue the license only with the fee. And the reason I'm telling you that is that only two universities didn't do it this summer, Portland State and Lewis and Clark, and they are our biggest graduates of candidates. And I have talked to both of their deans, and they have promised me that by next spring, when they send out their next round of graduates, they will be online, because every other university in the state is using the fast track. So we get in the neighborhood of 2,000 new graduates in the summer, in addition to people renewing their licenses and in addition to new applicants. So expedited service is the ability for us to issue an emergency license so an educator can start the next day while we wait for their fingerprints to come in, and we're able to review their materials and make sure they're qualified for the job. So in a usual year, we only do about 800 of those.
Thank you very much. The DAS recommendation, please.
DAS does recommend or concur with the LFO recommendation to increase other fund expenditure limitation by $220,000, with $100,000 of that being unscheduled until better whether the need is actually there.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carboni just summarized it. My recommendation is to increase other funds limitation by $220,000, with $100,000 of that being unscheduled until we know whether we really need it or not.
Any additional questions? Is there a motion?
The LFO recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schrader. LFO recommendation has been moved. Are there any additional questions? Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections, motion passes. Senator Schrader, will you carry?
Thank you.
Now we move on to my statements. The Department of Transportation. Sorry to keep you waiting. I actually thought that these items would be the most controversial, so that's why they're at the bottom of the agenda.
Please, Mr. Chairman, Craig Greenleaf, Administrator for the Transportation Development Division. And the request that we have before you today is to increase the budget limitation for the transportation program development portion of the budget. This is to cover the costs of certain planning activities that came out of congressional earmarked projects. The projects are specifically identified in our request letter, and we were unable to anticipate these particular earmarks, of course, because the congressional action happened after the budget approval process had been concluded. We are working to try and carry this work forward, reliant on consultant assistance. So even though there is some department staff time invested in these projects, the principal expenditures are actually to support the consultant work associated with them.
Ms. Jordan, do you want to add anything in terms of that?
To their description of their request?
Yeah.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The DAS recommendation.
Mr. Chair, Jim Carlin with DAS. We do concur with Legislative Fiscal Office's recommendation.
And Ms. Jordan, your recommendation.
Mr. Chair, we recommend that you approve the request with the understanding that the Department of Administrative Services will unschedule the expenditure limitation increase until actual need is demonstrated. Actual expenditure requirements vary depending upon performance of the individual contracts, and that's not completely predictable, so we are being cautious.
Is there a motion? Thank you, Ms. Thank you, Senator Schrader. Any additional questions? Any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections to the motion, motion passes. Representative Scott, will you carry?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Jordan will give us a brief overview of item number 59.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, item 59 is a request by the Department of Transportation to increase their highway preservation program expenditure limitation, because the number of preservation projects that they expect to complete by the end of the biennium will far exceed their current limitation.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation. During the last session, interest was expressed by the legislature to have ODOT move as quickly as possible to get projects out the door. Some projects are easier than others to get out the door. Preservation projects fall into that category. We've both moved more quickly with the work that was planned in this biennium and have advanced projects that were planned in future biennia, and that has put us in a situation where we need to come back and ask for an increase in limitation in our preservation program.
DAS recommendation.
Carboni, DAS does recommend approval of this request and concurs with Legislative Fiscal Office's recommendation to unschedule until the need is precisely known.
Ms. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we recommend approval with the understanding that DAS will unschedule the funds until actual need is demonstrated.
Move the LFO recommendation and congratulate the department for moving forward rapidly.
And I would concur with that. Congratulations. And actually, the more work that you can get done, the sooner you can get it done, the better.
We'll continue to try and advance by.
Yes, Senator Morse.
And Mr. Chair, I will make a special effort to advise Senator Gary George of this expenditure limitation.
Okay. And just to put a little caveat on that, the faster that you can get quality work done, the better. I still realize that this is not overpasses, but they need to last a long time. So with that, any additional questions? There's a motion on the floor from Senator Schrader to approve. Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections to the motion, motion passes.
Good job, Mr. Chair. You're awesome.